reconvening the House Interim Committee on Veterans Affairs. I think, first of all, what we have to do is we have to open a work session for our LC drafts that we're going to do as bills, introduction as committee bills. Qualifying statement, I have to open that, don't I? Open up a work session. A vote in favor of introducing a legislative concept is not a vote on the merits of the concept itself, and it's not indicative of a member's opinion or position on the content. Just wanted to make sure that everyone understands that.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, I move the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. Would you like those introduced all together at the same time?
You would read them out, that would be.
Okay. LC 1684, dated November 7, 2012. LC 1718, dated October 8, 2012. LC 1719, dated October 8, 2012. LC 1720, dated October 11, 2012. LC 1722, dated October 4, 2012. LC 1723, dated October 2, 2012. And LC 1725, dated October 3, 2012.
Co-Chair Wett moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1684, dated November 7, 2012. LC 1718, dated October 8, 2012. LC 1719, dated October 8, 2012. LC 1720, dated October 11, 2012. LC 1722, dated October 4, 2012. LC 1723, dated October 2, 2012. LC 1725, dated October 3, 2012. Any discussion? Seeing none. Is there any objection to us introducing these as a committee bill? Seeing none, so moved. Okay, I'll close the work session. Open up an informational hearing.
You gotta go?
Yeah.
Update on the World War II Memorial. We have Lou Jaffe and a video.
We have a video.
Yeah, is Representative Matthews in the video?
No. We can make that change very quickly.
That's me right there in 3 years.
Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Lou Jaffe. I'm president of the Oregon World War II Memorial Foundation. The charge of this foundation is to duly honor World War II veterans through this memorial project. And to that point, I want to quickly express gratitude to Representative Matthews for his leadership in requesting legislative support for this project. It is our understanding that this request for $250,000 will be brought before the legislature in the February rebalance. I also want to thank all the legislators, including members of the committee, that have signed on in support of this project. I think as you see the video and learn more about what we're about doing, you'll find it very compelling. But the short video you're going to see will become very apparent that this memorial will be much more than a static fixture. Its robust educational features will allow future generations to learn compelling lessons about honor, sacrifice, perseverance, and service to country. Indeed, it'll be an honor to all veterans. Quickly, the current status of this project is as follows. We have a $1.2 million budget. To date, we've raised $140,000 in cash and in-kind donations from our contractors. We have firm commitments of $250,000, and of course, we have a request before the legislature of $250,000. We're also actively pursuing other donors, foundations, and the community at large. And I can update you further if you'd like on that, but right now, I'd like to show you the video and that'll give you a good sense of what we're about. I have the same problem at the lunch presentation today.
I'm sorry, I left my hearing aid back.
Right. Well, I presented lunch today at the U.S. Naval Academy Association, and I practiced all the equipment, and the speakers I had weren't strong enough for the room, and it was a swing and a miss. It was a great audience, but once we get the audio fixed, this will be, you'll find this very compelling.
After I turned 17, the war was still on.
It was not something that you headed.
Sorry, I'll pause it for a second.
Do it was something that you wanted to do.
It was.
You may put the sound up on this as well.
It was your duty.
I lied about my age. I was 15. It was wartime, and I wanted to fight in the war before it was over.
I was 19. I wanted to serve the country.
We felt sorry for the people who didn't have the opportunity to serve.
About 150,000 Oregonians served in World War II.
3,750 gave their lives, men and women. They did a tremendous amount for our country and for the freedoms that we have.
A good friend of mine, fraternity brother, initiated with me, and he wrote me what they call V-mail. He didn't very pretty over here, he said. And then he said, I never knew how much I wanted to live till I got over here. Well, he didn't live much longer. When I tell you that story, how many more stories just like that? And that's what the war's all about.
We started up this hill. We were constantly harassed by snipers. And I was losing guys like the devil. I lost my platoon sergeant, my guide sergeant, my radio operator, my runner. But I finally got a radio, the radio operator. Lost my whole platoon headquarters, plus probably half a dozen other guys. And it was bad.
Our division liberated the Ohrdruf concentration camp. Seeing these half-dead people, the bodies were lined up like railroad ties, and the smell of lime, and that was the worst.
I was wounded on the fifth day of the battle for Iwo Jima. Mortar hit fairly close to me. And it cut the nerves, so I didn't have any pain in my arm. It also blew all the skin off my chest. The only time I cried during battle was as they were carrying me off the battlefield. I looked up and saw the Marines raising the flag. Seeing the American flag raising at that time, it's overwhelming.
These are incredible stories of people homegrown here in Oregon that have a lot to share.
There were plenty of folks who gave a lot who were on the home front. They didn't have to be in uniform. They were doing things for the war effort.
It wasn't just the soldiers and the sailors and the Marines out there doing the fighting. It was everybody fighting in their own way. The whole United States was in on this.
I think there were a lot more people than we know about on the home front who sacrificed a lot.
People of my generation and younger have no notion of what shared sacrifice is about. What, you know, what it means for an entire country to come together with a singular purpose to achieve a common goal. The world would have been vastly different had the United States and its allies not prevailed.
There are memorials for World War I, for the Korean War, for the Vietnam War, but there has been nothing for World War II.
There's all kinds of memorials to World War I, Civil War and whatnot, but seems there isn't really a memorial to World War II.
For Oregon not to have a memorial for World War II veterans, shame on us.
Oregon is one of six states that does not have such a memorial, and Governor Kuligowski and his staff really started this process.
Through the hard work of a lot of people, they've come up with a very compelling design for it.
The memorial will reside in what's called Wilson Park on the corner of Court and Cottage on the Capitol grounds. We've designed it to become part of the park, to flow evenly with the pathways and the look of the Capitol building. The footprint will be 75 foot square. At the center of this footprint will be a 33 foot high five-sided obelisk. 33 feet high because Oregon's the 33rd state of the nation.
And I think that's appropriate. Some symbolism, but it's a symbolism beyond what our eyes will see.
Along two sides of the memorial will be low black granite walls with the names of the fallen.
We'll also have on the grounds, which is all granite, a world map.
And in that map will be notations for each theater of war in which we fought.
As part of the educational aspects to this memorial, we're going to be using QR codes strategically placed around there so the younger generation with their smartphones and iPads will be able to key in on a different part of it and get a full story.
The memorial, by its design, will not just be a static memorial. We'll have an opportunity to educate future generations and tell these stories.
We're really excited about this bit of technology that us older generations sometimes don't fully appreciate.
I feel strongly that if we can inspire one person to greatness in this generation, two generations from now, this memorial will be well worth it. This is not about glorifying war. It's not about glorifying military might. Frankly, it's about glorifying the human spirit and what one can do if one must do it.
Well, I think it's important to remember our generation and our sacrifices.
The day of the dedication, with any luck, we will have a number of World War II veterans in attendance. And I know that the look on their face will make all this effort well worth it.
I'd like to see that built immediately before we all die.
I'm going to hit the big 9 in February. You better hurry. I better go raise that money quickly.
I'd like to come when they unveil it. I'd probably visit it 2 or 3 times more. You go there and you see a guy's name, it makes a difference.
I think it's very significant for people my age who were just born at that time in the early 40s to remember what our parents and grandparents did for us so we have the freedom we have today. That's why it's important to give money to the memorial so you become part of the memorial, literally, and part of the people who went forward for us, who sacrificed literally their lives that we could have the freedom today.
Yeah, I would encourage everyone to make a donation so that this gets built before all of us leave this world.
thank you for viewing that. As you can see, we believe this is more than a static memorial, and there's tremendous opportunity to teach kids, teach young people, the core of what citizenship means. And we can learn from the lessons of that generation. So I thank you for your time and attention, and I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
We have any questions? Any comments?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Matthews.
Thank you. I just, you know, not only should Lou be doing books on tape for all of us with that golden voice, but but he is just amazing as the president and the chair of this committee and doing the work that he does. And I've got to say, Lou, I'm here to tell you publicly that I apologize that I had taken a big chunk, more than I thought I could handle. And I had to back down from a commitment I'd made to Lou and sitting on that task force committee. And it's because these folks aren't meeting like we're subjected to normally with other committees. They are weekly. They are twice a week. They're on the phone. They're constant emails. I was overwhelmed at the amount of work is being done on this. And I got to say, just hats off to you. And if they're asking the legislature to find $250,000 for this project, I think we're well suited. But I want to put it in perspective. And again, I compliment you, Lou, and your entire group. You're just amazing what you're doing. But I want to say, to put it in perspective, you know, we were chatting earlier about politics and House seats spending $750,000. We're talking about $1.2 million to build something meaningful to a generation that could be somewhat felt as forgotten. And if we don't build it soon, we need to get on it. And so I would ask legislators, I'll ask all my colleagues, and I will challenge people to look deep into our ability, and maybe we can make contributions also from campaign funds and use political monies for worthwhile causes such as this, rather than kicking each other in the teeth. Thank you, Mr.
Thank you so much,
Mr. Chair.
Thank you all.
Any other comments or questions? By the way, Mr. Jaffe,
sir.
Jaffe, you were in Vietnam. Where exactly were you?
Two Corps.
I started out in the Highlands,
and then 1970-71, as things were winding down, my unit, we moved down to battalion headquarters in the Chemung Valley, which was just between Quinulon and Nankai.
Mm-hmm. I just went and saw the USS Yorktown, and they also have a display of Vietnam support, and the first thing I saw was a PBR, which we're all familiar with, and the Delta. And then I walked around the corner, and there was a Huey with a Seawolf emblem on it. So it was HAL 3 out of Canto Bintui, which I used to call on those people.
Okay.
And they were the most highly decorated helicopter squadron in Vietnam.
So you were in 3 Corps or 4 Corps then?
I was from I Corps clear down to the Delta because I was the supply liaison for all Naval Marine Aviation activities in country.
Okay.
So.
Well, thank you very much. And,
well, thank you, and welcome home.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Great work.
Excuse me. We have an update on ODVA, Oregon Veterans Home Loan Program, from Tom Mann and Steve Slag. Did I get that correct, Slag?
Yes.
Okay.
Co-chairs, members of the committee, the record, Tom Mann with the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs. My apologies for blinding you with a laser pointer.
Yeah, you were killing me.
I couldn't understand what the heck was going on there.
Did you see that?
Okay.
It was in his folder.
Yeah, I know.
There was no gun attached.
In the folder, and, you know, I used to be in the spy business, and sometimes those hidden things gotta get me. We're here today to give you an update and a brief on the home loan program. Got a short presentation to give you. This is similar to how we briefed 3-4 months ago. Maybe a little bit of new information to share with you. So I'm going to grab my laser pointer because I'm going to need it sometimes.
Please don't point it this way.
That's right.
Keep it on the screen.
I'll stand in front of you.
So as you see, we've in the lifetime of the program, we've loaned $7.7 billion to veterans in the state of Oregon. It was established in 1945 as a constitutional program. As a matter of fact, the legislature created this program before they created the Department of Veterans Affairs. And once they created this program, they had to create a department to run it. And so that's how the Oregon Department of Veterans Affairs came to be. There have been more than 334,000 loans made to Oregon veterans, and just a spectacular program, to be honest with you. hear a lot of the details about how this program works. A couple things I want to point out is the underwriting guidelines are made to Fannie Mae guidelines. You may have read in the paper that Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac may go away. And so we've been talking internally about if that happens, how we'll have to readjust our statutes to either whatever the new format is or best practices or whatever that might be, should Freddie Mac and Fannie Mae go away. Financing up to that $417,000 we talked about in the joint committee. And one of the really interesting things is we don't sell the loans. We service the loans for a lifetime. And that's kind of a big deal. I don't know if you ever had a home loan that got sold to three or four different people and you don't really know who you're making your loan payment to. What this allows us to do is follow the statutes. When somebody has a financial problem and are having foreclosure issues or whatever, we can work with them much more diligently than maybe the banking industry does. And in statute, it specifically says you are to do everything you possibly can to make sure someone doesn't have to foreclose their property, to keep that veteran in the home. That's in our statutes, in the 407 statutes. Long before all this mortgage crisis stuff happened, we were working with veterans to ensure that this home loan was one for a lifetime, and we're very proud of that. We have two types of funds, and this is where it gets a little bit interesting in what we do. The most of the money we use are what they call qualified veteran mortgage bonds. These are federal bonds, tax-free. These are the ones that are restricted. It's got a 25-year limit, meaning that you can only use those monies for 25 years after discharge. We can get about $100 million a year of it in bonding authority if we need that much, but it can't be used for a refi. And so the bulk of our monies that we use for the loan program are severely restricted. The pre-Allman monies, that's a former bond. They don't do those anymore, but we still have some residual monies for that. We got about $60 million. And it's one-time money. Once we use it, it's gone, never to be used again. Right now we're using pre-Allman to fund loans that are past 25 years. This body passed a resolution for us that ended up on the ballot to allow us to have take away the 30-year limit we used to have in the state for this program. Now it's a lifetime benefit. So we use the pre-Allman monies for anybody over 25 years to fund their loan. However, we've been having an internal discussion about taking about $30 million of that and using it for refinancing. It'd be a one-time project. $30 million, we figure we'd go through in 6 to 9 months, given the demand we have for refi right now. There are pros and cons to it. One of the things that we have to keep in mind is if you do this one time, those who don't get the benefit are going to be fairly upset. And so we're kind of weighing spending $30 million and then never having it again, but offering the refi product for a short period. And that's an ongoing discussion we're having internally. As you can tell, 92% of our inquiries are for refi right now. I was doing some historical research, and we're going to come to a slide that's going to show you just kind of the decline of the program over the years. In 2006, 2007, 2008, at the height of the mortgage industry, we were doing pretty well. We were selling making between $50 and $60 million worth of loans a year. That's pretty healthy for our product, which is a niche product. However, as the economy collapsed, we had 1 year we did 29 loans. We had another year, I think we did 11. Just really, really bad. The interest rates right now in the world are really low. We have our low rate at 2.99. It's fantastic. It's never been like that. I heard somebody refinance the other day on a 10-year for 2.5. I heard that the low rate in Oregon on December 7th was 2.67. So at 2.99, which is the lowest I think we've ever been, we're still getting beat by the conventional market, and they're offering rebate pricing and giving money back on top of that. And so it's been very, very difficult for us to compete, because the way this product was established in 1945 was the interest rates would be lower than the market, and which would drive veterans to the program and would be a benefit. When you can't compete with the interest rates, that's when our program suffers. This is the slide.
Can I ask a question?
Yes, sir.
Before you get too far. Why aren't we competitive, I guess? Because we should be bonding this money. How much does it cost us to bond that money? Or does it cost us anything to bond that money? Right. And if it doesn't cost us anything, how come we can't be competitive?
Chair Escobar, for the record, I'm Steve Schlag, a loan program manager for the state of Oregon. I think the answer part of that is that it does come with a basis cost. Banker of 28, 29 years, you know, we talk about basis of funds, the basis cost. The bonds do have a cost to it. I couldn't tell you at this very moment what our basis of cost is, but what I will share is that our costs for these bonds right now are at levels where we cannot compete with the outside markets. Today, as an example, I look at rates every day from a number of different lenders throughout the state because I'm concerned about the state of Oregon and not anybody else outside. And by the way, Tom's reference to a 10-year rate at 2.5 was mine. I just locked it. If I'd have waited a day, I'd been able to get it 2 3/8. But to put that in perspective again, it's the outside market rates, the monies can be borrowed cheaper on the federal level than we can on the bond level, even though there's federal ties to all that. In the marketplace, as Tom alluded to as well, we have issues surrounding rebate costs. those rebates come in the form of credits to the borrower. Now, with the passage of Dodd-Frank, that has left us in another position of a non-competitive posture. For example, today, a 30-year, I saw government rates open up this morning on a 30-year basis at 2 7/8, with a about 1.923, I think, was the rebate to the borrower. So you take that $200,000 loan, that equates to about a $4,000 credit. We don't offer those types of pricing adjustments because of the basis of the cost and the type of funds we get under the QVMBs that are our funding sources.
So please explain to me a little bit, and I don't want to hang you up too much because we don't have that much time, but explain to me about these bonds. The federal government's floating these bonds, or is the state of Oregon floating these bonds?
These are government bonds.
These are federal government bonds, and they're charging us X amount, which is over what we can borrow money from a commercial lender?
Having been a commercial banker, I can tell you that some of the I have seen commercial loans in the last year that have been about the 1.25 to 1 3/8 charge to the borrower. So yes, it's cheaper for the federal banks now to borrow from the feds than it is to attract deposit monies and then lend those out. So again, that's part of that picture that we have to deal with.
I'm just thinking of ways to help out. You know, like, why don't we borrow from the Fed? Can we not borrow from the Fed?
I don't know if we have any restrictions to do that or not, to be quite honest with you.
I'd certainly like to see us be competitive. Anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah, because it's one of those issues for me, Representative Esquivel, that I don't like to finish second. Never have.
I like that attitude.
And, you know, we talked earlier, speaking of those who were members of the military, I recall I went to take my physical when I was a freshman in college and failed the physical. 3 hours later, I was a starting pitcher for my college team and threw a complete game two-hitter, but yet I couldn't pass the physical. So be it.
That makes sense. Go ahead.
So, committee members, this is the slide I was referring to. You'll see in the day of 1991, we were at about 114,000 loans on our portfolio, worth about $3.5 billion. We were pretty healthy back in that day. And we've slid. Part of that is we're not sending big armies across the pond to fight wars anymore and having large armies come back home looking for benefits. Part of it was the recession that's happened. There are lots of reasons. Today, we are sitting at 2,271 loans. I want to remind you, 114,000 loans to 2,271. Our loan portfolio is $215 million, roughly $216 million. Our delinquency rate continues to be below standard. We like it about 1 to 1.5. That's what we've been over the bienniums. We're a little higher now because of the economy. For me, the strangest thing has been veterans just walking away from their homes that are underwater. We've had a lot of that where we've tried to work with them and help them in their homes, and they say, nope, just walking away.
Intellectual foreclosure.
Exactly, exactly. We only have 9 counts right now out of that portfolio that are in foreclosure. I will say, too, that this body passed a mediation bill that said if a person goes into foreclosure, you mediate unless you're doing a judicial foreclosure, meaning you're going through the courts. Our agency is the only organization in the state that I know of that actually has done it. Everyone else has gone judicial, so they don't have to do the mediation. And that's on top of the statute we have that says we already have to keep everyone in their home. And so we've done everything we possibly can to keep folks in their home. The question that brings us here is this slide. What can you do? And I will tell you that these two bills have been in Congress, 834 and 1595. We submit them every year. There's always seems to be something more pressing. We've not had the kind of champions on these bills that we need, but 834 would allow the refinancing for qualified veteran mortgage bonds, allowing us to use those bonds for refi. At $100 million a year would be a substantial benefit to the agency. I was asking Steve the other day, I said, how much refi money do we need a year? He said, $50 million. $50 million is what we could do a year in refi if we could do refi. The second bill would change that qualified veteran mortgage bond to a lifetime benefit like the federal VA loan instead of it being a 25-year benefit. We suspect that those bills will go nowhere right now, and we're going to resubmit them. And the Oregon delegation signs all the time. It's just a matter of trying to get traction. So one thing is, as those congressional delegates are in your districts, buttonhole them. That's how you help and make sure that they understand that even though we do this every year, this is important. It's important to the state. It's an economic development tool. It is important to these veterans coming home, and I'll share this. The military says it's going to downsize by 1.5 million in the next 5 years. Oregon can expect about 30,000 veterans to come home. If a quarter to half of them need veteran benefits, it's a tsunami. However, there's an opportunity because a lot of those folks are going to want to get into housing. And so right now is when we need to get this fixed. We're highlighting these three. We are proposing the elimination of the two-loan limit. And it was interesting because Representative Parrish asked us that question. Is it 417 total or is it each loan 417? And we kind of had a sidebar conversation. And we're going to go back to our administrative rules and find out did we paint ourselves into a corner with that? Is that a federal regulation? Because we may be able to do something by rule to increase that, which would be a great thing. But in terms of the limit, that's currently in statute. We need to get rid of it. That federal VA home loan guarantee, if that's something that the body thinks would be a good idea for us to do, that bill that deals with allowing us the flexibility of over 100%, that's the bill we'd need to pass to take the first step to do that. And then lastly, we've talked to you about this before, and we're talking about it now, is what's another funding source? Is there another non-restricted funding source that the cost of funds are not so great that we can still be competitive interest rate-wise? And that is something that we're talking internally about. We've had creative ideas such as having PERS invest in our organization, keep the money at home, and talk to the Treasury. We talked to Treasury when Ben Westland was Treasurer. We talked to him about what can we possibly do to get some money flowing our way to do these refis. We just haven't come up with the right answer yet. And so even though it's a kind of a limited lane and we have a niche product, it's something that we'd like to discuss further with you just to try to be creative about what we can do here. Any questions you have?
You're talking about $50 million a year?
Optimally. We think we could do $50 million a year. I would settle for 10 to 15, honestly, just to have a product that you could open every year.
Any questions?
Do you have anything else, Tom? First of all, I'd like to see, I don't know how many of us are, who's, I think you and I have the same representative in Congress, John, that's Greg Walden. But if each one of us could maybe send a letter, if you want to give us some bullet points to do a letter to him, send it to us. We'll be happy to step forth and request that we pass the passage of those two bills. I mean,
I've never been asked to do it, but I think it would behoove us to do so.
Yes, sir.
So, is that okay with you?
Yeah. And I was going to tell you, I think Cameron's trying to get to the dais.
Okay, you need to come up.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Cameron Smith, policy advisor for Governor Kitzhaber on military and veterans issues. One last area, these folks did a great job showing what we could do federally and at the state level, but from the budget perspective, one way that we've been shooting ourselves in the foot is taking a lot of our loan reserve money that should be going to pay down these bonds and pay them off and keep the cycle going within that veterans home program. We've been taking roughly about, you know, probably since early 1990s, there was a fund shift from general fund to reserve fund for core services within Tom Shop of just veteran services in terms of our veteran service officers and our other programs there. So that's $1.6 million that's eating into this reserve fund that should be kept within the Veterans Home Fund. So this is the first year in 20 years that we've driven into the governor's budget a fund shift from the reserve fund to the general fund of $1.6 million. So when you see the governor's budget for veterans area, you'll see a significant 1.6 increase in general fund. But just wanted to clarify, it's not above and beyond new services, but simply making sure that we take care, not shoot
ourselves. Backfilling the hole that we've dug.
Correct. And that's been, you know, if you do the math, that's probably $50 million that we've taken out of the Veterans Home Program to put into core services. And just from a philosophical standpoint, it's strange that we're funding core veteran services off of loans that veterans themselves are paying back.
I really feel that we would do extremely well in the refi market because it's a niche market. The second thing would be it would be beneficial to the department.
It would strengthen the loan portfolio.
And incredibly. It would strengthen the whole program in itself because of the, but it's a specialty market in the aspect that you cannot get a federal VA loan for refi at 100%, I don't believe. You can purchase a house for the first time, but you can't refi. It's a 90-10, I believe, on a refi.
I'm trying to cite, since I've been trying to go through the formatting of the federal VA home loan program, there are conditions where, yes, you can do 100% in a refinance transaction.
Totally.
Especially if you're a service-connected disabled veteran.
Oh, a disabled. Okay. Yeah. Okay. But what's the disability? 50% or more?
Just have a rating.
Yeah, that's correct.
You can have a zero rating and still be a disabled veteran.
Really?
Yep.
How do you do that?
As long as you have a rating from the United States Department of Veterans Affairs that say you're disabled at any percentage, you are considered a disabled veteran under federal statute.
Well,
there's also a refinance cash out product that FedVA has also introduced here a couple of years ago. But, you know, again, coming back full circle to what we talked about earlier is, even if we were able to originate federal VA loans, we're still in the same boat when it comes to refinance issues. Our hands are still tied. Yes, you can do a streamlined, you know, refinance, which is by fundamentally a rate and term. However, we can't do it internally because we're prohibited by the fund sources that we use. So the runoff would continue. There are two words that strike fear in the heart of a banker. One is auditor. The other is portfolio runoff. And our issue, portfolio runoff, has been a devastating factor with this program.
I would hope that we would come up with some suggestions and bring it back to this committee on how we can get out of this because, you know, I always look at things like this. If we don't like the rules, let's change the rules.
And co-chairs, I do not expect the federal changes to be easy. It's driven into the tax code, which is a nightmare to ever get changed, even when there's broad agreement. This is five states that have a program like this. Big ones like California, Texas. That should get some weight going, but it hasn't gotten traction at the federal level. We can control our destiny if we make a strong push on this fund shift through ways and means. If we look, there are trade-offs in terms of if we use some of the non-restricted funds, that strengthens our portfolio in the short term. Short changes those veterans that didn't get into that, but that might prove the case to the legislature that this is a good deal for Oregon, that then we can free up lottery or other bonding internally beyond that. So I think we've got some good options in the short term, I think, to discuss come session.
Well, I'm sure we will come to a conclusion, and I'm sure we'll get there eventually if we just keep at it.
Yes, sir.
So. We're willing to name it the Representative Esquivel.
There you go.
I'm glad you didn't say Memorial, sir.
There you go. Me too. So thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you, sir.
Okay, we're going to have a Washington County Housing Services for Veterans, Eric Belt from Washington County.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Esquivel and Co-Chair Webb and members of the committee. For the record, I am Eric Belt of Washington County Disability, Aging, and Veteran Services. And I'm also an Army veteran. When I went into the Army, they sent me to airborne school, and then in their infinite wisdom assigned me as an intelligence officer in an armor unit, so beyond my initial training in
you
airborne school.
You jump out a perfectly good flying aircraft, and they made you put you in intelligence?
I must not have been very good at it, because they sent me to an armor battalion.
Airborne all the way, and then some.
And then some.
So you probably couldn't call me a paratrooper, even though I do have a paratrooper's badge. I'm also the Washington County Veteran Services Supervisor, and I've been with Washington County for about 5 years now. And I'm the current president of the Oregon County Veteran Service Officer Association. So my first time before the body, thank you for the opportunity to present an overview of what county veteran service offices do in Washington County, as well as you could extrapolate what we do to the other counties within the state of Oregon for the most part, and how we integrate in to the to services that are provided by other government organizations as well as community-based organizations. Excuse me if I switch my glasses and put on my over 50 glasses here. The Oregon County Veteran Service Officers are uniquely positioned to meet the needs of an ever-increasing number of veterans and their family members by virtue of being situated at an intersection that allows them to connect veterans and their dependents to resources that can best suit their needs. And we do follow the no wrong door philosophy. When they come to our office, we will provide them with services that are available directly through our own organization within Disability, Aging, and Veteran Services, as well as give them a warm handoff to any other organization that might fall within their primary scope of responsibility. CVSOs assist veterans in obtaining resources to include VA compensation and pension, health care, education, burial needs, employment, and housing. Their work contributes to restoring honor and dignity to those that have given so much to the service to the country. And the mission of Washington County Veterans Services in particular, as well as other CVSOs throughout the state, is to advise, assist, and advocate for veterans that reside within their particular counties. We accomplish that mission by providing a variety of case management and referral services to local veterans and their family members. First, through what you might come to mind when you first think of a county veteran service officer or a veteran service officer just in general, through assistance with completing VA claims through the process for service-connected compensation as well as war-era earned pension benefits. And in fact, if you look at the latest governor's balanced budget proposal, you'll see that 84% of all claims filed under ODVA's power of attorney in 2011 were in fact filed by county veteran service officers. VSOs are fortunate to be able to assist veterans in obtaining the benefits that allow them to buy a home for the first time, perhaps, or retire with dignity. Many times, you heard Tom Mann state earlier at the joint session, very few veterans actually apply for benefits that they have earned, and these are earned benefits. These, I tell veterans all the time when they come to our office trying to see what might be available, to assure them that these are benefits that they're earned. They're not taking them away from anybody else. They honorably serve their country, and they deserve these benefits if they're entitled to them. So apply for them.
I think most veterans, I know back when I was in the service, which is back in the old days when they fired on Fort Sumter, but we were never explained our benefits. No one ever took the time to explain them to us. We were just DeRosa and out of the service and kind of like, well, thanks a lot, see you later. And no one ever sat down and explained the benefits. So, and I understand we're doing that today, which is very good, but you know, sometimes they just don't want to hear it at that point. So we need to do a reconnect, and I think this is very important.
And that is very true, and we have to reach out to the veteran when they're willing to listen and absorb the information that we have, and through the reintegration efforts and the Yellow Ribbon Program, you know, that's been a moving target for how best to intercept that veteran, that they can be most receptive to the information that we have. And even informing folks that served in the military that they are, in fact, are a veteran. Many people think just because they served in the military, that doesn't necessarily mean they're a veteran, because if they didn't deploy, or if they didn't serve in combat, or even if they spent an entire career in the military and retired, and I'm eligible for VA benefits, I'm receiving retirement benefits. So we work with to break down that barrier of understanding every day. When we provide advice, referral, and information regarding enrollment in VA medical system, that includes enrollment application assistance. I recently received a phone call from a mother of an Afghan veteran who was desperate. She said when after her son came home that he had difficulty leaving his bedroom and almost never left the house, and it was there some medical assistance available for him. Not realizing that the VA provides free health care for 5 years following discharge when they return from a combat zone, regardless of any other eligibility requirements. And so that was an easy one to fix. Somebody who had a desperate need that could easily be fixed to connect them with the proper resources. We also provide advice, referral, and program information about a wide variety of other VA benefits, as mentioned previously at the top, but I want to talk about a couple in particular. Advice and referral to community-based programs, including the housing service-related programs. With respect to compensation and pension benefit assistance, my staff in particular at Washington County, we advocate for our clients. We assist in the initial interview process and work through the bureaucratic maze that exists that sometimes makes it difficult for the veteran to even be able to apply for those benefits once they're aware that they may be entitled to them. If they should disagree with the ultimate decision that the VA makes, then we also provide appellate representation as well through the hearing process at the local level at the Portland Regional Office, as well as before veteran law judges at the Board of Veteran Appeals. And you always want to try to take care of this claim up front, because if you ever do get into the appellate process, it adds years to the process. And when you hear those horror stories about the veterans and or their family members that have been seeking benefits for years, that's where that primarily comes from.
Representative Matthews, you have a question? I think Representative Matthews will help you.
Oh, thank you, Chair Esquivel. I just want to encourage all veterans out there listening and VSOs that are listening to encourage their veterans to get their appeals in as young as they can, because you don't get the answer back overnight. It's a sad thing we're working through on the federal level, right? Well, through the appeals process, but thank God for VSOs that know the ropes and can guide the veteran through the process.
Well, it's like getting a certificate of eligibility for your veteran benefits, and you send in your DD-214, and how long does that take?
Sometimes can take a while, although there is a program that the VA is emphasizing now. It's an e-benefits program where if you sign up for it, you can request certificates of eligibility as well as DD-214s directly online, and it is an effective system in many cases and it's quicker. And a VSO can obviously assist the veteran to sign up for that particular program. Just in Washington County alone, there are On an annual basis, $82 million in compensation and pension benefits are being received by veterans and their family. Those are tax-free dollars that are spent within the community that they live, and obviously the economic multiplier effect then has a much larger impact upon the community than just those that are meeting the needs of that individual veteran and or family member. And that works out to be over $1 billion within the state of Oregon. So it's a significant amount of money that is coming into the economy of Oregon, and considering how few veterans of those that are eligible for the program, you could see that if they did fully take advantage of the benefits that are there, that would be a significant enhancement to the economy. I just want to briefly talk about the direct assistance and the collaboration with various organizations within Washington County. One, we have a joint coordination with for PTSD counseling and family education counseling with the University of Pacific, with their Pacific Psychology Clinic. We have a contract out of our general fund that helps assist in assessing and providing counseling for veterans. That sometimes can be easier for a veteran to go to kind of a vet center concept. It's not a government-run program. They may have been resistant to treatment, to going to treatment for many years. I helped a Vietnam combat veteran who refused to seek treatment even though he was aware that he was suffering from PTSD. And when he came in to talk about benefits, I suggested this particular program. He was able to go to the program, get an assessment for PTSD, agree to counseling, and that supported a successful adjudication of his claim for service connection compensation. We also have worked over the last 2 years with Ride Connection to develop a veterans driving veterans program where veterans will actually volunteer with Ride Connection to once again break down the barriers that some veterans are resistant to seeking services, but yet they will accept it from another veteran. Speak their language, and those veterans that are providing the volunteer service bend over backwards to help them and not just take them from point A to point B to their medical appointment, for instance, but also take their spouse to the stop at the pharmacy or even to the grocery store or to have their hair done. So it's a very flexible program. We also work with WorkSource Oregon in hosting an annual stand down for job benefits, veteran benefits, and job employment opportunities. This last fall, 150 people attended that. 50 went through the employment center. Five actually received jobs from that, so 10% was, I thought, pretty good, as they met with 12 employers. And then we also have joint coordination and support for emergency assistance through ODVA with the Emergency Assistance Fund, as well as a local indigent fund that we maintain in our office, small, to give money to veterans that need to make it to a medical appointment. We maintain a small food pantry for folks that are in need on an emergent basis, and recently worked with Solar World for a fund drive where they raised 3,825 pounds worth of food that was matched by their food provider, and we were able to distribute that to local VFW American Legion posts, as well as working with the National Guard and the Force Grove Elks. And we also maintain a VA work study positions within the office that provides for additional job opportunities for veterans that are going to school. And we also provide our work with as joint coordination with housing services through Washington County's Housing Services, the VA's Community Resources and Referral Center, the VA's HUD-DASH coordinator, Ann Connor, in our area, Salvation Army Veterans and Family Center in Beaverton, run by Rick Stoller, and as well as a variety of other community-based housing services within Washington County. We recently worked with Community Action to develop and obtain a supportive services veterans and family grant that is being administered through Washington County, Columbia County, Clatsop, and Tillamook counties. And that works out to be about to assist 35 Washington County veterans and their families. We recently, that program began in October, and we recently assisted a veteran who was living actually in a tent in a backyard for over a year And as a result of this grant opportunity, he, Community Action was able to provide him assistance into moving into a home. Cause he was already service-connected with a disability through the VA, but couldn't afford the moving costs. So this program was able to assist him in transitioning from a tent in a backyard into a home. And I understand from just prior to coming down to speak before you that they were able to place him in housing this past Monday. So from the end of October until this past Monday, he was finally able to secure long-term housing. And finally, one of the most important parts of what we do every year is we work with service organizations and nonprofits in support of the annual point in time count. The importance of that is to identify chronically homeless veterans within our jurisdiction that then can be reported and support the establishment and of the HUD-VASH vouchers that are available to provide sustained housing for veterans. But the way the program works, unless that chronically homeless veteran is identified within that last 10 days of January during this point in time count, then they're not considered to be homeless for official federal numbers in support of this grant. Currently, they're, according to the official count, there are 62 chronically homeless veterans in Washington County. Obviously, that doesn't pass the smell test when you think about how many people are homeless. But this particular program has to abide by that particular count. So this year, this coming year in January, we're working with the local VFW post, the American Legion post, as well as Community Action and a variety of other volunteers to actually see what we can do about working with those posts as they're spread throughout the county. They know their local area. They know the folks that come to them on a daily basis seeking services, and hopefully we'll be able to count a more reasonable number. Obviously, one homeless veteran is one too many. And we have currently 25 HUD-VASH vouchers assigned to us in Washington County, and we use all of them. So we definitely could benefit from an increase. Thank you for your patience. And in conclusion, Oregon County Veteran Service officers support our veterans and their family members in obtaining resources that improve their quality of life, restores honor and dignity to those who've served their country, and we strive to meet the increasing demand for our services, and I believe that no other organization can reasonably hope to obtain for such a small investment in funding the level of support that CVSOs provide to the community. And I thank the committee for your support. Questions?
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Eric, thank you. Mm-hmm. Appreciate the presentation and the work that you do. You said you're the president of the association this year?
Is that yes, correct? Sir.
Okay. Through the Ways and Means process, because ODVA is one of my budgets in my Ways and Means subcommittee, and a couple of years ago I had identified what I perceived as a disconnect, maybe, or a lack of training on the part of county commissioners in relationship to what a VSO does. And so I worked with ODVA and Association of Oregon Counties for AOC to start implementing a training session for new commissioners coming in through their commissioner college. And so I welcome you to give me feedback at any time. Feel free to contact if you get feedback from VSOs out there that feel that they're not quite getting the support out of their county commissions, and it's probably, just a disconnect in training and understanding what the VSO does. Let me know so that I can help correct that early on.
Thank you, Representative Huffman. I appreciate that support, and that is a very valuable service to educate the county commissioners about that. Recently, Commissioner Diane McKeel from Multnomah County helped establish a veterans subcommittee to the Human Services Committee in the AOC, and that has been a great help in bringing together, and I know Representative Escavilla, you've listened to some of the phone conferences that we have. It's open to all members of the VA, the House VA Committee, as well as the Senate. We have a variety of county commissioners that participate on it, as well as ODBA with Tom Mann and his folks, and Cameron Smith attended the last meeting. So it provides a great forum by which to raise veteran services issues before the county commissioners, and I think it's it'll do great work. So I support your...
Good news. Thanks.
Any other questions? No more comments.
Thank you.
Airborne either.
Oh, thank I just you. Maybe appreciate I should it. Share Thanks. That with Eric.
Thank you, Chair. Your service.
Or not.
Or not. Oregon Housing Authorities and Veteran Housing Issues. We have one panel. Let's see. Let's see. I have a change on that. First of all, Ryan, step forward, please. And we'll call up two panels.
Thank you. Chair Escobel, Chair Witt, thank you very much for letting me come and testify today. It's an honor to be here. I am representing the Oregon Housing Authorities and the Community Action Agency.
Could you identify yourself, Ryan?
Oh, yes, thank you. Ryan Fisher. And I work with the Oregon Housing Authorities and the Community Action Agencies. Thank you, Chair. Because of the work that I do, we have a website, and oftentimes I get phone calls from people who are looking for housing because they see the name housing on our website. And those are the calls that I don't enjoy receiving, because they're usually people who have already called through a number of different folks and are frustrated and are tired, and it's a hard conversation to have. About a year and a half ago, I got one of those calls, and I have a laminated sheet next to my phone with all of the different numbers that I can refer folks to, because we get them often enough. But I could hear in the voice of this person I was talking to that they'd been referred too many times already. And so I listened to what their story was, what they were calling about. And I was talking to a young man who was about my age, who had a wife and a daughter, and the daughter was about the age of my own daughter. And also, like me, he had just moved his family from Texas to Oregon in order to start a new job. However, unlike me, he had fought in the first Gulf War. And now he was in a situation where, even though he had this job, he didn't have enough dollars to stretch until that first paycheck came. In addition, he qualified for some housing help, but he didn't have the necessary identification. He didn't have the IDs that he needed from his military service in order to get that done. So I'm thinking, well, you know, I work in housing. I know a lot of different people around the state, and I started making phone calls. I called everybody I knew, and then after they told me what they knew, then I called everybody that they knew. And over time, there were a lot of people who I spoke with who are very smart in the state, who know about housing, and they gladly shared their expertise with me. But they warned me that the resources are tight and that this story was probably likely not to turn out the way that I wanted to. So as that weekend approached, the weekend where he told me that he was going to run out of the ability to stay where he was currently at, I'd made a lot of noise, but I hadn't solved the problem. And I thought a lot about him and his family that weekend. And specifically, I thought about what I would tell my daughter if I were him, what I would tell my wife. Chair Escobel, we've talked about this. I'm not a veteran. I'll never understand what it's like to be a veteran. I'll never understand what it's like to go through basic training. And most importantly, I'll never understand what it's like to see combat. But I do understand that I have a commitment. I have a commitment to those that have served, to do my part to make sure that when they come home, they have a place to live. And I believe that we all share that commitment. So today you're going to hear from people who are ready to honor that commitment. They're here to bring their skills, their experience, and their expertise on a problem that needs to be solved, which is making sure that all of our veterans have a place to live. You're going to be hearing from housing providers, you're going to be hearing from case managers, and most importantly, you're going to be hearing from some veterans. Just to let you know, I heard back from that veteran the following Monday, and he had left me a voicemail, and he said that, I don't know who you talked to, I don't know what you said, but I got a call on Sunday. They said that everything was going to move forward, and we're moving into our place right now. And let me tell you, the sound of that voice was the best thing that's happened to me since I started this job. It was an incredible feeling, and it was an incredible moment. And I want us all to share in that moment. I want us all to feel that hundreds and hundreds of times over the next several years. This is very important, and I think that we have an opportunity together to make sure that those who have fought to make sure that we have a home have a home. So thank you for letting me kick this off, and I'm looking forward to you hearing the stories that folks have to tell.
Thank you, Ron.
Any questions?
Just a quick comment, Mr. Chair.
Not an airborne.
No, I will stop reminding you that I'm a paratrooper.
Someday you fall in the ocean, we have to pick you up.
Just, we've been misdropped before. I just want to mention, you know, the passion that you're seeing here today is what's consistent with the way Ron approaches his job. And we are linked, and I alluded earlier to a bill that we're pre-session filing on affordable housing for our veterans, but he is just doing a phenomenal job, and I just want to make sure that I just say thank you for all you're doing. Look forward to continuing to work together and getting this completed, because you're a man on a mission, and I'm willing to help. I appreciate what you're doing. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I just, for my two bits, Ryan, I want to thank you for your heart.
Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you.
Next, we'll have Val Valfrey. Is that correct?
Correct.
And then Kenny LaPointe and Dwayne Reynolds. Okay.
Good afternoon, Co-Chair Escobedo, Co-Chair Witt, and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Val Valfrey, and I live in Forest Grove. I'm the Executive Director of the Housing Authority of Washington County. I'm a member of the Governor's State Housing Council. And more importantly for this meeting, I'm also an Air Force vet, 25 years, and with combat service in Vietnam. Thank you for hearing my testimony today about the critical need for veterans housing in Oregon. This testimony, however, is not about me, for I was fortunate to come home to back home to a home, a loving family, and a job. Rather, my testimony seeks to honor and to advocate for those who served our country with valor and now in turn seek help from a grateful state and nation. Far too many veterans, as you know, are homeless in America, estimated between 130,000 and 200,000 on any given night. Over three times as many veterans are struggling with excessive rent burdens and thus an increased risk of homelessness. It is also staggering for me to comprehend that at least one of every three homeless men sleeping in doorways or alleys or boxes in our cities and our rural communities have at one time put on a uniform and served this great country. This is unacceptable. Oregon, as you know, is a home of choice for many of our nation's veterans. More than 330,000, both men and women, live here, and nearly 250,000 have wartime experience. Shamefully, this number also includes nearly 1,500 homeless veterans. This, too, is unacceptable. I firmly believe that the words homeless and veteran should never be used in the same sentence. Nor should any veteran ever have to live in the streets or be relegated to life's shadows. Not if we are truly to honor their selfless service to this country. As a Housing Authority Executive Director, we recently had as many as 6,000 families on our housing wait list, both veterans and non-veterans. While all persons deserve this respect, I routinely remind staff that they have only one opportunity, just one, to get it right by our veterans. Just one opportunity to listen patiently to what they have to say, just one opportunity to give them factual and timely advice. In my experience in serving as a veterans at a veterans counseling center, I found veterans were often distrustful of government and its promises, as they had little patience with bureaucratic barriers and excuses and runarounds that to them appeared to end up nowhere. So when veterans make the effort to come off the streets or out of the woods or they come onto our doorstep after returning from deployment, we have a ceaseless obligation to bring value to their efforts. Otherwise, they will be gone and we won't see them again. And in Washington County, we do this, and other counties within Oregon. We offer the HUD-VASH vouchers, and we're also a partner in the Supportive Services of Veterans Family Grants. But these are very limited resources. Our presentations today discussed a continuum of housing and services that are critically needed by our veterans. ranging from emergency rent assistance to transitional housing, permanent supportive housing, veteran-specific housing development, and home ownership. Emergency rent assistance is a flexible, powerful tool that can help prevent veterans from becoming homeless in the first place by enabling them to stay in their home or, if evicted, to be rapidly rehoused by augmenting rents and deposits. Transitional housing allows veterans a safe harbor to effectively transition from the streets or emergency shelters to housing for up to 24 months, after which time they should have the resources and to be able to transfer to permanent housing. Permanent supportive housing offers long-term housing stability with possible wraparound supportive services that are unique to the veterans' needs. It is this capacity that the HUD-VASH vouchers can be so effective in restoring veterans to self-sufficiency. We also at Washington County use project-based vouchers to help to provide supportive service to our veterans. Veteran-specific housing development refers to construction or rehabilitation of existing products that address veterans' special need issues. The VA capital and per diem program is a case in point where the VA provides 65% of the capital cost to a project and the sponsor agency provides the remaining 35%. It's getting to that 35% that sometimes holds some of that construction done. We need that financial assistance. This creates brick and mortar facilities where support services can be focused. Two examples where veterans do well in projects that have a community of veterans are in the St. Vincent de Paul's Veteran Housing in Eugene and the Salvation Army's Veterans and Family Center in Washington County. Unfortunately, as you have heard recently here, Oregon has a robust veterans home ownership program, but there are unmet barriers in that program for veterans who need assistance with down payment and rent closing fees. In summary, as you listen to these critical housing needs that will be addressed, I hope you will take away from this presentation and those that follow that we need to restore honor and dignity to our veterans by providing opportunities for housing, jobs, and services. I thank you for hearing my testimony. We'd be happy to answer any questions you might have. Thank you.
We'll go ahead and save the questions for the last when everyone in the panel is finished. So.
Co-Chair Escobal, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. My name is Kenny LaPointe, and I'm from Central Oregon. I'm the Housing and Resident Services Director for Housing Works, which is the business name of the Central Oregon Regional Housing Authority. And thank you for hearing my testimony today. I've had the privilege for the last couple of years of working with the VASH program, which is Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing, through a partnership with HUD and the VA, which provides tenant-based rental assistance to veterans who are chronically homeless in our region. It pays a portion of the monthly rent for veterans who qualify. The VA determines eligibility of those veterans, and the Housing Authority, my organization, administers those vouchers. So we pay the rent. We're the bank. We've been operating the program, like I said, in Central Oregon for a couple of years. Congressman Walden was pretty instrumental at the onset of getting the program going when it may have been a little bit slow to start up, and we appreciated his help with that. A couple of gaps that I noticed up front with the program was that there was a lack of investment in security deposits, the upfront costs that veterans really needed to get into housing. While we had the resources to pay the monthly rent, it really didn't make a difference if we couldn't get them into the units in the first place. So security deposits were pretty crucial. Other gaps that we saw were lack of ability to pay application fees, maybe lack of credit to get into units that they needed to get into, and so they were being turned down in a lot of cases. And chronically homeless veterans in a lot of cases will not have a history of established credit. So those were definite issues. Other issues that I noticed personally going out and inspecting units is that while we may have been able to house some veterans, is their units were empty and they may not have been like a home. And while we were housing them, it wasn't necessarily with dignity. Mm-hmm. And that was a big lack as far as I was concerned. And it was unacceptable. These difficulties, I think we can really fix them by establishing some sort of flexible resource that would provide those veterans with the upfront resources that they need to get into units in the form of security deposits, application fees, those kind of things. We've also seen difficulty in finding private landlords who are willing to rent to folks who may have lack of credit history or no established tenancy history. And veteran housing providers in our area, we've had some great partnerships with organizations such as the Central Oregon Veterans Outreach. Those partnerships have been really crucial in providing housing for the veterans that need it. Without that, I would say that quite a few of the veterans on our program right now would not have been housed. And in some areas, we've literally found zero landlords willing to rent to folks on the program. So housing developments centered towards veterans are going to be crucial for the success of this program and for the success of veterans that we're wanting to house. Some creative solutions that we've come across in our area is we went out and while we saw the lack of resources for security deposits, lack of resources for application fees, Central Oregon is a tough community, and when we see a lack, we go out and ask for it. And so we really did just go out and start asking folks for money to help with these upfront costs. We went out and asked folks for furniture to help furnish the units that veterans were living in, but while we were able to help quite a few of them, it still ended up coming up short, and that's really where we feel that we need more local investment into these types of programs. So that's kind of the point that we're trying to get across today. Another investment that we've made is into ready-to-rent programs, which help provide veterans with the resources and the education around renting units. And a lot of landlords throughout the state are accepting the ready-to-rent program in lieu of maybe lack of credit. And that program's been pretty crucial, and more investment into that program would be necessary as well. Thanks for hearing my testimony. I'd be happy. We'll wait for questions for later.
Co-Chairman Esquivel and Co-Chairman Witt. My name is Dwayne Reynolds. I'm a veteran. I am a veteran of the Army, honored veteran. I was chronically homeless for 19 years after I left the military. 2 years ago, I became sick and didn't know how to get well. Through the VASH voucher in the last 2 months, I am looking more forward to getting stable again. The VASH voucher has helped me to start finding myself after 19 years of not knowing who I was. I do now know who I am, and I'm looking forward to going through school through the VASH counselors. They've started me with schooling, and I'm learning a new trade so I can become a working member in society, because I broke my back a few years ago so I couldn't work anymore. So now I'm moving forward with my life. It's going a lot better. For a long time, I looked at sleeping in a doorway as where I was going to die, and today I don't see that. It's through the VASH voucher that's helped me not see that, and it's a very, very important process for us to help the veterans. There's a lot of veterans out there that don't know what to do. Once they get on the streets, they don't know what to do. They turn to alcoholism, a lot of other things. With this voucher, it helps people. It's a very important voucher for our veterans. And if you have any questions, thank you for letting me speak.
Any questions? Co-Chair Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dwayne, thanks very much for sharing your story with us. I think it's very, very important. And one of the problems that this committee has entertained and wrestled with is the fact that there is like, not unlike yourself, a lot of chronic homelessness among the veterans population. One thing that's been reported to this committee is that for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is a mistrust of government and a lot of other folks, that oftentimes homeless vets don't want to come home. They don't want to come inside. I'm hearing from your story that for at least part of those 19 years, and I don't know for how long, it would have been your preference to have had adequate housing.
Well, what it was is that for me and a lot of the veterans that are living in the bush, well, we weren't trained to live in a house. We were taught to live in a bush.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we know.
Mm-hmm.
We come out of the military, that's what we know. We know how to live in a bush. That's what we're trained to do. So that does have something to add. You know, if nobody has ever told you that before, a lot of us don't know other than to live in a bush. That's what we're trained to do. That's our whole training. The whole time we were in the military, they may have had quads for us to go back to every now and then, but most of the time we were in the bush. So that's what we know. We don't know anything other than that. We know the bush. And so we're more comfortable because that's what we know.
Uh-huh.
And to live in the that's the comfortability of it. But at the same time, we don't want to be there. We just don't know how to admit that we need help to get out.
Thank you. And you expressed precisely what I was trying to get at, vastly better than I can. And I'm wondering, without putting you on the spot and without giving you advance warning that I was going to ask this question, but as someone who has experienced this for 19 years, are there things that you could suggest to us that we could do better when we attempt to reach out to veterans who are in the bush and who may want to come inside? How would we better approach them? How would we encourage them to come inside? How could we gain their trust so that they would avail themselves of the kinds of services that Val and Kenny provide, along with a host of other
people? First of all, treat them more like people.
Mm-hmm.
Address their issues more with counselors, more counselors. The main thing, though, for veterans is a trust issue. It's a major trust issue. You have to gain their trust to show them that actually they're not going to be put back out there, or they're not going to be put in a certain type of program that is going to rule their life, because, you know, the military already ruled their life for so long. They don't want to go back to the military rule. And so that's a main issue with a lot of the veterans. Mm-hmm. Is they don't want to live underneath the thumb. You can't, but we can.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the number one issue with the veterans, is that you can't, but we can. Is the living under a major authoritative rule that tells them, well, you can't have visitors, you can't have guests, you got to live behind a closed locked door, mm-hmm. you know, in a closed locked security building. That's a lot of the issues with a lot of the veterans, is they don't want to have to live underneath that rule.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you very, very much. And I know that Chairman Esquivel welcomed home a previous veteran. Welcome home. Literally, welcome home.
Thank you. Because you guys helped me with a home. So, thank you very much.
Representative Boone.
Thank you. I apologize for missing most of your presentation. I had to be in another meeting at the same time. So, thanks for coming and sharing what I heard of your story. And I live out in the countryside, so I have some vets out there too. And sometimes they're hard to find, and you know you need to find them, but there are ways. And I kind of heard what you were saying about that, and that's exactly what my experience is. So knowing the right person to send the message to get to the veteran you need to get a hold of. And for me, it's the bottle return in Cannon Beach for one guy.
Right.
Yeah. I can leave notes if I have to.
I have a couple things. One is that Mr. Reynolds, would it have helped and behooved us as a nation that obviously, I assume you were in a combat zone when you were in the service?
I was not. I served during a 3-year time that we were actually at peace.
Oh.
Yeah, I served from 1980 to 1982, so we were actually at peace. We were not in any police action at that time or anything. So I joined during the Iran-Contra, but by the time I got out of basic training, the Iran-Contra was over, so I went to the Hawaiian Islands in the Pacific.
I was curious, when you talk about counselors, is this effect just from the military structure itself, or I'm kind of curious there?
Well, I think with the veterans, you know, a lot of us not knowing exactly what to do when we get out of the military, because for me, I got out 30 years ago. I did 3-year stint. I got out 30 years ago. My training was obsolete by the time I got out of the service. What I was trained in the military to do was obsolete when I got out. I was a tactical wire operations specialist, switchboard operator. 1982, they're switching over from switchboards to computers. So there was nothing for me to go out to with the field that I had been trained in. It was obsolete. So veterans getting out, it would help a lot that if we make sure our veterans are put into places that are going to help them as they come out, and counseling will help a lot.
What we're trying to achieve now is we're trying to keep a veteran, especially the ones coming out of the theater, the combat theater, is to give them some downtime so we can observe them for quite some time instead of, like myself, I was in Vietnam one day, 2 days later I was stepping off, discharged off of a sidewalk in San Diego, California. That was my downtime.
Right, well, that's what happened to me. 72 hours from the time I was released, I was dropped out onto the street with nowhere to go. I didn't really have a family that really cared, never did. That's why I joined the military at the age of 17. So there's a lot of veterans that are coming out that don't have anybody. They went in with nobody, and they come out with nobody. They don't know what to do once they're out. They don't know what to do with themselves. So
thanks for your service. I appreciate it. Get in touch with me because I have some ideas for raising some money, if you would. And Mr. Valfrey, where were you in the country?
I was flying both B-52s and C-141s, but most of my time...
Out of Utapau?
Out of Utapau.
Okay.
I flew into Utapau, also Da Nang. I flew into Da Nang, flew into Cameron Bay, into Tan Sanut. Brought home people in bags from Da Nang, which was a very sobering experience. I was under attack there at Cameron Bay and spent time kissing the...
Oh, you love those bunkers?
Well, this was on the, I was out on the tarmac, though, and they blew up a fuel site. I had, you know, the Viet Cong were attacking. We had tracer fire and going, and I was out of my airplane. I already shut down the engine, so my crew, you can't really hide very much on a flat surface there, and it seemed like forever. But I have all the respect for the guys.
Well, thank you for your service. I appreciate it. Thank you. Next, I'd like to call up Don Rogers, Don Meyer, and Mark Jolin. Is that Jolin or Jolin?
Jolin.
Good afternoon. Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, members of the committee. I'm Don Rogers, and I live in Springfield, Oregon. I'm with the St. Vincent de Paul Society of Lane County, and I work in the Vet Lift program, which is a transitional housing program for veterans. Thank you for hearing my testimony today. I am testifying on the need for veterans housing in Oregon. I grew up in Springfield, and I'm an Army veteran myself. I served 5.5 years. I experienced some abuse in my home when I grew up. So I joined the Army shortly after high school, looking for all those things that probably a lot of people look for, some acceptance, a place to belong, family, and a way to serve my country. While I was in the Army, I experienced some additional trauma, and my way to deal with it, and I think a lot of veterans' ways to deal with trauma is to use alcohol and to suppress it and to deny the trauma occurred and to deny that there's any evidence of that trauma. The reason why I tell my story is that it's not unique. The majority of the veterans that come to our door have experienced something similar. There's been some childhood trauma. There's been some military trauma on top of that, whether it be from military sexual trauma, combat trauma. And these veterans have oftentimes developed some serious substance abuse issues trying to self-medicate. Also, there's denial of mental health issues that cause the veterans to self-medicate. When these veterans get to VetLift, they don't really know what to do or where to go. And that's where case managers like myself and John come in. We act as advocates for the veteran. We do intense case management. We meet with the veterans in their homes at least once a week. From the time that the veterans come into our program, we start making a plan for them to exit our program. We work with the veterans to create a case plan addressing three main goals. These are permanent housing, increasing income, and self-determination goals. Many times the self-determination goals have to do with addressing mental health issues, addressing sobriety, or reconnecting with lost family members. One of the things that we do at VetLift is we have weekly meetings where all of the veterans get together. And at these meetings, we like to have a meal. We call it kind of a weekly family dinner. And what we want to do is we want to get these veterans into an environment where they can relate to their peers without using drugs or alcohol. And we want to normalize the experiences that they've been through. So many of the veterans have similar experiences, and the staff has similar experiences to the veterans, that we all work together to try and move them forward and reintegrate them into society. That's all I have. Thank you for hearing my testimony.
Co-Chair Witt, Co-Chair Esquivel, members of the committee, my name is John Meyer. I'm a Gulf Warrior Army veteran. And when I got back to the United States, I came to Oregon, and I had a real hard time fitting in. I was quite alcoholic by that point, and got to Oregon and discovered an entire new arena of substances that I could abuse. And from 92 until I was finally arrested and sent to prison in 2003, I was homeless, I was on the street, and I was buying and selling drugs to support my habit. I received a 10-year prison sentence, and because none of the crimes that I committed were violent crimes, I was eligible for good time, and I was also allowed or eligible to participate in an intensive inpatient drug and alcohol treatment program in prison. I served 5 years and 7 months and got out May 9th of 2009 and was paroled to Eugene, Oregon, and went to Sponsors, which is an organization that provides some temporary housing for people coming out of prison. In the process of getting myself signed back in to the VA for health benefits and such, I saw a sign on the wall, a poster on the wall that said, "Are you a homeless veteran? We have free housing for up to 2 years." And that sounded way too good to be true, but I looked into it, and in fact it was true. There was quite a waiting list, but I went down to the Veteran Service Office, the VSO downtown, and I was able to get my one-time emergency grant monies from the state of Oregon, which paid some rent at Sponsors until there was a bed opening at VetLift with St. Vincent de Paul, and I came into the program. And simply because I had available to me a free place to live, I was determined to do something with my life. And Being service connected, I was eligible for Chapter 31 educational benefits. It took a few months to get those going. I spent 6 months in GPD housing, which is completely free. I had a few roommates that weren't clean and sober. By that time, I had about 6.5 years clean and sober. And when I got myself ready to go to school that fall, I applied for a HUD-DASH voucher and was awarded a HUD-DASH voucher. And St. Vinny's, in the same complex, in the same set of complexes that we have the GBD program, we also have some permanent housing. So I moved into an apartment and I started school, and I'll be graduating this spring with my bachelor's in psychology from Northwest Christian. I was asked about 3 years ago by St. Vincent de Paul if I would come on board as a peer case manager, and I have I've been working there ever since. The beauty of the HUD-DASH voucher program is that should you start to earn any monies, and you join the family self-sufficiency program, which is another HUD addition to that, they will escrow the amount that your rent goes up, so that when you move out, you'll get that money back to buy a house. I also applied to the state of Oregon through the CASA home buying program, which it's administered by a number of different places, but I did mine through HACSA, which is the HUD representative. And so,
just for the record, would you explain to us what these programs are you're talking about?
The GPD is grant and per diem. That's a grant and per diem. That's a program.
I can relate to that.
All right.
And CASA.
And CASA is it's a low income home purchasing program where the state of Oregon matches for every dollar that I contribute. The state of Oregon gives three. And I have 3 years in which I can contribute up to $3,000, and the state of Oregon then will match that with $9,000.
Okay. But see, you're talking, and we do the same thing. We talk about, what we always use these.
I'm sorry, the acronyms. And the thing is,
we speak a different language, and the people out there in TV land, they don't have a clue what we're talking about.
Well, and I think, being with military background, it becomes just second nature to. I apologize. So the FSS, and that's the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. I'm wanting to stress how blessed I've been by having had an environment where there was a number. We have nearly 50 veterans in combination between our permanent housing program and our GPD program. We also have a small contract bed program too, but we have it's an environment where we're all veterans. We're all broken veterans. In order to qualify for the program, you need to have a substance abuse problem as well as a mental health problem. And I'm a poster child for both of those. By being in a veteran community and by living with other veterans that are they're at least understanding. They may not be equally as disabled as I might be, but we're able to get along, we're able to understand each other, and we're able to help each other learn to integrate back into what has become a foreign place for a lot of us. It's incredibly important that we continue to maintain funding for these type of organizations. I'm going to be leaving my house in June of 14. I start my MSW program up at Portland State this fall. So I'm not quite sure how I'm going to afford to be making that house payment yet, but I'm hoping that I know something will come through. But none of this is, when I look back at 92, and I think about that guy that went on to do what finally got him put in prison in 2003, today I have a driver's license, I have a car, I have keys to the office, I drive the company car, I have an expense account, I was a criminal and an addict, and I did that because I didn't know better. I had an addiction problem, I had the mental health problems, and I didn't know where to go for help. And thank you for hearing my testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Co-Chair Esquivel, Co-Chair Witt, my name is Mark Jolin. I'm the executive director of a nonprofit organization based in Portland called JOIN. And we're not an agency that is specifically set up to serve veterans, but because we do street outreach to people in Multnomah County, we work with a lot of veterans every year. In 2011, when we did the point in time street and shelter count for Multnomah County, there were 221 veterans in Multnomah County on one night sleeping on the sidewalk or in a park or under a bridge. There were another 446 who were sleeping in a shelter or some transitional housing situation. So more than 600 people who had served our country who found themselves homeless on one night. That's not all the people who became homeless in a year, but on one night.
Isn't that interesting that in Washington County there's only 61?
And that may be a function of how the counts are done. But I think the number is clearly too high, no matter how few it is. But at least for Multnomah County, that was our most recent count. So I think we're all here today to ask that there be a dedicated local funding stream to support the full range of housing needs of our veterans. And you've heard stories, I think, from some of the folks here about how well it can work if we make the investments that are necessary, how life-changing it can be for veterans who have been out on our streets. But I'll just come back around to sort of the four areas where I think the investments are needed. One is on the emergency assistance side, and that is really helping veterans who are currently in housing to keep the housing that they have. So there we're talking about eviction prevention. And from an investment standpoint, it's certainly the most cost-effective thing we can do, because if we allow a veteran or any person to become homeless, the time and energy for them and for us as a community to help get them back into housing is going to be much more substantial. The other is looking at ways to provide supports in permanent housing, so versions of permanent supportive housing for veterans who need more than just one-time rent assistance, who really need some more ongoing support, maybe a deeper subsidy in their housing, but also some counseling supports to maintain the housing that they have. There's also a need for additional support for home ownership opportunities. Homeownership is a critical path to stability for a lot of people in our community, and that certainly includes veterans who are coming home. And the last place, and Kenny spoke about this earlier, is really looking at ways that local dollars, because there's a federal initiative to end veterans homelessness by 2015, and the federal government is putting forward quite a few resources, but they're not going to be able to do it just with federal dollars. They're going to need to be some local investments, and we need to find ways to have local dollars to leverage those federal programs. Dollars that are coming our way, and the VASH program is a good example of that need. Because as you heard Kenny say, there's a great value to a VASH voucher. It's going to pay a veteran's rent going forward. They'll never pay more than 30% of their income towards their rent. Whatever the difference is between that 30% and the actual rent on the unit is going to be covered by the housing authority. But a veteran who has a VASH voucher in hand can't, from the Veterans Administration right now, get support with application fees, can't get support with paying for identification that they may need to get into the unit, are not going to be able to get money for a deposit in most cases. They're not going to be able to get help furnishing an apartment that they have. And so a lot of the basic, and they're not large dollar items, right? An application fee is $50. A deposit is $700. The kinds of smaller investments that streamline and certainly make it quicker to get into housing, but in some cases, if I've got a voucher but no way to pay the application fees, that voucher isn't worth anything to me. Right now in Multnomah County, we have about 305 VASH vouchers in our region. And there's an effort to try to get 60 leased up quickly. So trying to get fully leased up by the end of this year. Those 60 VASH vouchers represent about $600,000 a year in rent assistance from the federal government if we can get them leased up. But our Veterans Administration was struggling. Their caseworkers were struggling because they didn't have access to the kind of funds that I was just talking about, application fees, giving veterans bus tickets so they could go and make applications. So what we did in Multnomah County is that the city and the county, our United Way, and the Housing Authority chipped in $10,000 each, created a pool of funds that's actually administered out of JOIN, but we're really just the bank, and it allows the caseworkers from the Veterans Administration to come and access the flexible dollars that they need to help the veterans that they're working with deploy those VASH vouchers. It's not a lot of money, but it's critical money, and it's leveraging. So that $40,000 is going to leverage $600,000, a one-time $40,000 investment, assuming we even spend it all, will leverage $600,000 a year going forward in rent assistance for veterans who critically need the support, as you've heard here today. So I thank you for hearing my testimony. I'm happy to answer any questions that you have, and I thank you for your support for this effort to find funds.
Do we have any questions yet? Here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, we've heard just a moment ago that avoidance of problems is not only the cheapest way, but probably the most effective way to go. And I'm thinking about you and the conversation that you had with Chairman Esquivel, and you landed back in civilian life one day. I think you indicated that you didn't have a family support structure. And because of a lack of a number of things, you ended up on the street. Again, without trying to put you on the spot like I did the last panel, have you had an opportunity to think about if the following things had been different? If I had that family support structure, if I had a job, if I had a house, I wouldn't have ended up in substance abuse and ultimately in prison. And I ask the question because I'm looking at what could we be doing better for our returning veterans to make sure that they don't go through the same sort of internal turmoil that you went through, both mentally and I guess physically.
Representative Witt, that's I want to answer it honestly, but on the other hand, I came from a place that I don't know how much truth there really would be. If I were to tell you that had there been a GPD housing program, had there been a place to live, had there been case management, it might have worked. I was a pretty hard case. I probably would have abused that. I probably would have found a way to continue. The VA was doing its best to take care of me medically. I was seeing a psychiatrist. I was abusing my psych meds. I was drinking. It's hard to say. I want to believe today, having spent 3 years in case management, mm-hmm. and having had the pleasure and the benefit of seeing some pretty hard cases turn into real success stories, I want to think that, yes, if we had that housing, if we had that case management, if we had those things available, people wouldn't fall through the cracks. I believe that if it weren't so hard to wrestle these dollars out of the different organizations and agencies and different funding sources, if the money were there and if we could actually present it and have something ongoing, but we fight from budget to budget. But I think I want the answer to be that yes. If the resources were there, I'm going to be a social worker. My prayer in life is to be able to help, especially the young returning veterans today, not go through what I did. I think that if we had enough people on the street that had some experience and if we had some comprehensive long-term funding to provide housing and the case management support that needs to go with that, we could probably help an awful lot of people.
Thank you very much for your candor, for your very honest answer. Congratulations on turning your life around.
Thank you.
And as Co-Chair Esquivel has done in the past, our committee welcomes you home as well.
Thank you.
Any other questions? I do want to say to all the veterans that are out here that have experienced problems coming home, I'm truly sorry. I'm very sorry that we haven't taken the proper steps in order to help you with your needs. I'm very sorry when you tell me what has happened to you, and more importantly, I saw what happened to my generation when we came out of Vietnam, as probably Mr. Valpery in the back can attest to. Had a lot of people that headed for the bush, and they headed for the bush because they distrust their government, they distrust the society. They were treated very poorly, and they were never back in the field. And for that, I'm truly, truly from the bottom of my heart, very sorry on behalf of the state of Oregon and on behalf of the United States. The one good thing is we were very fortunate in Oregon to have a great Secretary of State at the time. I wrote a letter and received a state flag from Clay Myers in a letter back in return. And then this is one of the major, I thought it was a major thing. It's not a big deal to anyone else, but to some of us in the Veterans Committee, we found out that flag fund had been depleted. So Senator Johnson and I cooperatively went out and raised $15,000, and today that fund is alive and well. So anyone that's in a combat zone can request an Oregon state flag, and they get one free of charge, just like I did when I was in Vietnam. So, but I am sorry for both of you, for all of you. So, thank you and welcome home.
Thank you.
Oh, yes.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I just, and I echo your apology, but I also want to say that we are better for you sharing your story. I can't tell you how much I appreciate the folks that are willing to come to this committee and lay it all out and drill right down to their core and say, this is who I was, this is where I'm heading, this is where I'm going, and this is who I'm going to be. It's very rewarding. Two terms ago, I came in that hallway after our first meeting. I said, looking forward to doing great work for veterans. And my colleague right here had been seated for a while, and he says, we've been doing good work. But that work won't matter if we don't get feedback. And we're not going to be able to do it without input from the folks that need it the most. So we can say, we're veterans, we're here to help. But I'm not in your situation. I was fortunate enough that I didn't land in that situation. I don't know what it's like to be homeless. But I know what it's like for somebody to pour it out to them and say, here's my situation, I need help. So I just say, we're sorry, but we're working on it. And Oregon stands proud for its veterans. And I can tell you that without your ability to just open yourself up, fillet it out, and say, don't judge me, I'm just sharing, that means a great deal. And thank you for doing that today. Everybody, thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you. Appreciate it. Well, is there anything we'd like to discuss for the betterment of the order? I do want to say one thing. I really, this is our last interim committee meeting. Some of us may or may not be on veterans next time. We're not sure. But I do want to thank each and every one of you for your work and, more importantly, for the fact that you really care. That I thank you. And you, Co-Chair Witt, I couldn't ask for anyone better to work with.
We're right back at you, Mr. Co-Chair.
And moving forward, Mr. Chair, I hope everybody's had an opportunity to share with, Representative Kotek, moving forward, more than likely our speaker, about the importance of veterans' issues, and they deserve their own committee. They don't deserve to be handed a bill at a time, passed throughout committees. They deserve their own issue, their own committee. And I know we're a two-a-day committee, but the prioritization needs to be, and the message needs to be strong, that veterans are important to the state, they're important to this legislature, and we need to have the committee for our veterans. And if they want to throw emergency management in there, have at it, but keep veterans whole. So,
by the way, I want to say to that, Representative Witt and I, as co-chairs of the Veterans Committee, went into a meeting with the co-speakers and found out we were the most productive committee they have in the House. And
you were surprised?
Well, I really was. I couldn't believe it. So we were the most productive committee they have in the House and the Senate. So,
well, Mr. Co-Chair, I want to thank you for all of your efforts here. You've been tremendous to work with. As a veteran, I know that all the other veterans in this state can be very, very proud of the work that you've done and your dedication.
Thank you. Thank
you. Bet.
Representative Booth.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I am the only person on the committee who's not a veteran, but
No, I'm not.
Oh, I thought you were. I've enjoyed this committee very much, and I've asked to continue in it. And when I heard the next speaker mention emergency management or preparation and preparedness in the same sentence, I think we have a half a chance, and it makes sense because the OEM has been put into military department, and when we have a disaster, who comes but the veterans of our state and those in the Guard now who are active Guard, and they're just amazing what they can do. They're resourceful and they like to help, and we love them. And so I think it makes a big difference, and we are having, that's why I had to be at that other meeting. We're talking about the upcoming Cascadia event. Much of my work has been in preparation for that, and we're getting prepared on the coast. And unless you live in Hermiston, you're going to be affected. And you'll be infected in Hermiston, not infected, affected in Hermiston, because a lot of the coasties are going to be moving over there. So we're all in this together. So hopefully we'll
My memory serves me correct. Two sessions ago, or 2 years ago, maybe 4 years ago, when you get to my age, the years just go by fast. But we did have emergency preparedness and management in with the veterans, but we had one. Then we didn't have it. We had it, and then we didn't have it, and now it looks like we're going to go back to it. So
we're going to throw ocean policy in there too, just for fun.
Well, I like your tsunami arrows that just point uphill.
Yeah, that's a big message right there.
Well,
so thanks for your work.
Yes,
hope we
a round of appreciation for the chairman.
Yeah.
Thank you very much, and again, Representative Witt is an extraordinarily fine man to work with, and I really appreciate him very much from the bottom of my heart, and so he needs a round of applause as well. Without further ado, adjourn.